Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance FIL 240 for spring semester 2026.
Today, financial markets. This is actually not a deep subject. It has a lot of terminology in it. And there's not math at all in the first part of the course. Yay for that. But you will have some terminology to deal with as you go through this, as we go through the different types of financial markets. And those are great questions for, for like definitions, quick true and false, fill in the blank kind of things in a quiz or an exam. So do take good notes on this one. This actually dovetails with the first thing that I always do. Let's look at the numbers. And the numbers are always going to be the first thing we do. And in this case, I will be bringing in some more new terminology as we look at these markets, and I will expose you to stocks themselves, the stock screens. But a broad overview of the markets. As you can see, the Dow is up half a percent or so, and the S&P 500 is up 0.4%, and the NASDAQ is up 0.16%. That is an unusual pattern. Usually, it's exactly the opposite. The Dow is up the least, then the S&P is up more, and then the NASDAQ is up even more. Now, is this a bull or a bear day? Well, he helped you. What did you say, though? Did you say, who said bull? It's not bull. It's bull, okay? It's a bull day. It's a hard bull day. We had a really hard bear day yesterday. I mean, all of the markets were down. They took a toilet break. And this is sometimes known as what we call a dead cat bounce. The markets were just killed yesterday, and the cat got up off the road, and it's walking around now thinking it's still alive. Why did the markets go down yesterday? Absolute terror at the prospect that there really is going to be a major military confrontation. And with that, before that, there is a threat from the United States that we're going to lay even more tariffs on European goods. And that is just rattling the financial markets, especially here in the United States, because that is an indication that you get into a tariff war, you're getting into a major recession. As a matter of fact, through the 1920s, we had a string of three very conservative, very free market presidents, and there was a massive separation occurring between this very small group of wealthy and the larger group of middle and lower income people who were getting worse off. And it was building up, and the legislature and the White House were controlled by very free market, let it work itself out kind of things. This is how it works. As the wealthy get wealthier, they'll make jobs for everyone else and all that. Well, it buckled in 1929 on a very black day on the market. They just dropped through the roof. What was the thing that popped burst that bubble? It was that the Congress, in order to cover its butt, declared that the whole problem was due to these foreigners and these foreign competitors. And so they slapped on this comprehensive, massive set of tariffs. The Congress put them into, passed the legislation. The president at that time, Herbert Hoover, signed the bill into law, and just the markets, that's it, game over, and they crashed in 1929. The fear is that that's where we are about where we are right now. However, we do have a dead cat bounce day. So the Dow was up Nothing spectacular, but 0.5% is 0.5%. That's not bad. And then the S&P 500 was up, not as much. And then the NASDAQ was just barely up. In other words, that vast ocean of smaller companies, they barely ticked upward 0.16%. Now, if you look on the other side of the world, if we go last night, we had Tokyo that was rolling along, and that would be the Nikkei 225. Now, remember that if it has numbers after the name, that means it's an index. It's not the exchange overall. It's just a sampling, in this case, of 225 representative companies of the Tokyo Exchange. And in that one, the Nikkei was down about 0.4%. And then looking up to the north in Asia, you have the Hang Seng was actually up a little bit. And that's fine because China is going to benefit from us cutting off our markets to Europe. That they're just going to come in and say, oh, we can take care of you. Our companies are right there, ready to go, whatever you want. And it's incredible how complex and structured their ability is to deploy one or another or a bunch of different industries on a moment's notice. And that's why they're benefiting from it, and their exchange is up. Now, over on the other, coming into Europe, though, we can look at, well, for example, the CAC 40, Paris Exchange, 40 companies. Remember, it's an index. That would be 40 companies on the Paris Exchange. They were up a little bit. They struggled. You see how they were tailing down, but then they began to come up. Okay, we're good. We're going to be okay with this, with U.S. cutting us off and imposing even worse tariffs on us. So they did okay. And then London, that would be the FTSE 100. You notice that they're all following the same pattern. They were sliding downward early in their trading day. And then around noon, they surged upward. They're sort of following the same pattern of bad news and then, okay, we've got good news, everything's going to be okay, or at least it's not going to be terrible. One thing that we do want to look at down here is commodity markets. And during the lecture, I'm going to separate markets into one type versus another type. Commodity markets are a physical market. And if you can look over here, you'll see that now we are really getting close to 5,000 per ounce on the gold. Recall that last semester, I told you that last semester, at the beginning, we were up below $3,000 an ounce. And then it started surging. And I told the students, we'll see 4,000. We did. And I'm telling you, we won't probably, within a couple of weeks, we'll be $5,000 an ounce on gold. That is a very bad sign for if you're not an investor in gold. Simply because gold is the safe harbor of all safe harbors. You run to gold when you have run out of options to protect your investments. It responds favorably to inflation eroding purchasing power. It responds favorably to bad news economically and politically. This is the market, that part of the market saying, it may have been good times for all of you. You think everything is fine. We are expecting a disaster. And that's what the gold market is telling us right now. $5,000 an ounce is like unheard of territory. It's historic, and you're seeing it in pretty much in real time. And in this class, I will make sure that you know what this means. Instead of listening to others tell you this, that, and the other thing, you can look at and see it with your own eyes. What could possibly be going happening here? Now let me go down here and now crude oil has had a tick upward. It's still very cheap. Oil is right now, and this is crude oil is a general overall average of crude prices. Now, crude oil, as I told you, is actually, there are many grades of crude from this awful, thick, sour, smelly, hot stuff that my group of wildcatters used to pull out of the grim places in Texas, on over to this light sweet Brent crude, which is just really easy to refine into different types of hydrocarbon products. It's just great stuff. So it's always going to be a little more pricey than the overall average of crude. And if you look here, both of them have come up just a little bit. They were down, crude oil was down in the, I think it hit 56 a barrel, and it's come up from that. But it's nowhere near the prices that scare people up in 80, 90, a dollar territory. And just to say this again, I think I said it to you last week. Crude oil prices collapsed months and months ago. OPEC just turned on the spigots on its oil production and that, just to drive the price of oil down. The reason they did that is simple. They wanted to break the backs of the smaller oil producers. Because if you're out there in the patch in Texas, $60 a barrel, you can't feed your family at $60 a barrel. It's not worth it for us to even fill up our trucks and drive out there to look at places to see if they're prospective for an oil punch. It's just not worth it. So you break their backs, you drive them into bankruptcy, and then that's when you turn around and you jack the prices through the roof through cutting the oil supply out of OPEC. It's a classic strategy. They've done it before, and they'll do it again. Oil prices are low right now. They'll wait. They'll keep them low by producing lots of oil until the competition is out of business, and then they will turn it around and turn those oil spigots off, and the price will shoot up to $80, $90, $100 a barrel. Truth be told, as I told you before, really for the smaller oil producers to be okay, you have to have oil around $75 to $80 a barrel. Get it much below that, you're starting to suffer. Get it above that, well, that's great, but until the competition comes in, because the prices are so good. But that's not the only thing we can look at. We can look at other commodities, prices, copper, silver. Now, they are responding more to supply and demand dynamics. Gold responds to supply and demand, but it also responds to speculation. So you have this group of investors who speculate on gold, the metal gold. They aren't so much doing that with other metals, which are just being priced based upon the supply of the product and the demand for it in industrial, cosmetic, residential purposes for silver, gold, and all that, for silver and copper, and other ones like that. But anyway, I'll take you over here just briefly to show you bond markets. Bond markets are safer than stock markets. And you'll see why as the course goes along. But you consider it like this. If you are really, really bullish on the economy, you'll buy stocks. You know, they're risky. You can win, you can lose a lot, but you're in the mood. A bull goes after risk to a certain extent. However, if the markets become shady, if you're beginning to worry about the economy, about companies being able to generate revenues and all of that, you will move your portfolio away from stocks and toward bonds. You'll sell the stocks, and that will cause the price of stocks to fall. Then you're taking your money that from your sales of the stocks and you're moving it over to the safer bonds. That drives the price of bonds up. Now, later in the course, you'll see that prices of bonds going up mathematically means that their interest rates are going down, their yields, as we call them. So, a flight to quality means that investors are moving away from riskier investments and toward safer investments. That's a first stage flight to quality, from stocks to bonds. You know it's happening because stock prices are falling and bond prices are rising, which is to say the bond yields are falling. So if you see stock prices falling and yields on bonds falling, you have a first stage flight to quality from stocks to bonds. Now, if you look at the benchmark 10-year, its interest rate. Do I have a 10-year? There's a 10-year right there. Okay, that's kind of like a benchmark. There are so many different kinds of interest rates, and a lot of interest rates are based upon more basic interest rates, like treasury bonds. So we look at the 10-year as sort of like an indicator of where all interest rates are going. Now, in this case, what you see, you aren't seeing a lot of the yield. Last semester, bond yields had made it below 4%. That's good news, simply because the interest rates, lower interest rates, stimulate the economy. Companies borrow more money to build factories, buy equipment. They stimulate households to borrow, to buy cars, to buy durable goods. So we love to see interest rates going down. However, we don't want them to go down just because the Fed is printing money. We want them to go down because the economy is running smoothly. On the other hand, we don't want to see them go up because that has the opposite effect. Higher interest rates, less borrowing by companies, less borrowing by people, and that's what we're seeing. We got down to about 3.95% about this time last semester, and they've been crawling back up ever since. They're now back above 4.25% right now, and the higher they go, the more they will drag the economy downward. The truth of the matter is that right now, you're getting a lot less investment in bonds. Especially, we have a lot of foreign investment in our treasury bonds. And the foreigners are basically more and more simply saying, no, we're not going to fund your budget deficits. We're not going to fund your lifestyles. We're sick of you. That's basically the view of the world right now. And you can bitch all you want about the political implications, why this is happening. The reality is that the interest rates are going up. Gold is going up. We just had a hard, bear day, close to a black swan. That is not opinion. That is just hard data doing that. And this is what we have to do in our field. We can have all the political opinions we want. We can have our social opinions. But when the markets act, they act on pure greed. They don't care who is running the show. They want to know, is the show good or bad? And so that's where we are. Now, I want to show you something here. I like this one. This is a sector map, is what it's called. By sector, was it a bull or a bear day? Green is bull, bear is red. And as you can see, we are having a dead cat bounce today. The technology sector, notice how big that is. That is sort of like the 800-pound gorilla of the modern American economy. It's having a bull day. See all that? See, that's green. As a matter of fact, across these these sectors, most of them are green. Interestingly enough, and I've noticed this, and I don't have a really well-formed understanding of why, but the consumer defensive, they seem to have a red day a lot these days. It's nothing major, but it seems to be there's a bearish sentiment about these consumer defensibles. And then the utilities are having a red day too. But for the most part, this is a bull sector map. It's mostly green. That means most sectors of the economy, those stocks in those sectors, are going up today. And that's very, that's not that unusual. Now, a little of the logic behind the dead cat bounce. It works like this, and this is from a trader's point of view. Okay, I've seen a really bad day. And so we had a flood in this room. You all came down here and a flood wiped you all out. Well, now, you know, not all of you deserve to die, to drown. You, I mean, you're down there like way underwater and you don't deserve to be. You're pretty good. So what I'll do is I will go and drag you back up. I'll buy you. You're a bargain. This is a bargain hunter's kind of game where everything is dragged down and I'm going to save you. I'm going to pull you back up. You're a bargain at that low, low depth. Get back up here. So there's kind of like a bargain hunting after a really hard down day. That's why you see those dead cat bounces, is because of all of the bargains. I mean, if every stock is going down, you can't tell me they're all bad. So what I'll do is I'll rush through. And I actually did this morning myself. I rushed through and looked. Okay, I see a couple here, you know, good heavens, that dropped like 18%. Nah, that was way too much. It was just being dragged down in the program trading. And so I'll just start grabbing those. And that can create a nice dead cat bounce on the market as the bargain hunters go in and find bargains, of all things. It's a very well-known phenomenon. And that's one phenomenon. And that's one of the things that I always tell people. First of all, look, don't ever panic in a market down, even if it's a hurricane down. Don't pee yourself. Just hold the line. Now, you can shift your portfolio, but do it without fear. The reality is that we had a really, really bad series of days in late 2008 and into early 2009. There were two kinds of investors we looked at. The ones who panicked. They sold everything. They just got out. And they're the ones that just wrote it down. The ones who panicked recovered to their original levels in about 5 to 6 years. The ones who just held on, wrote it down, or wrote it back up, 2 years. That's all. You see, that's one of the things that we learned, they teach you since time immemorable in the military. Your job is not to panic. Your job is to panic everyone else. Turn the field into chaos. You control it. You can stay calm and then let them scatter, because that's the easiest way to pick them off. Those investors who were selling out, they were just selling at whatever price they could get to save themselves. They were fresh meat for the ones who were just, they'll come back up someday. And that's a good idea. You see, this is not short-term investing. This is how you survive the long run. As the great leader Leonidas of the 300 Spartans yelled to his 300 soldiers, he said, "Spartans, hold." And 10,000 Persians coming at them were wiped out, because as soon as those spears hit them, they started running and screaming, and they were easy to finish off. Now I want to take you to a stock. We'll just look at one today. And I'm thinking, let's Netflix and chill. NFLX. It has four letters. What does four letters mean? Do you remember that? Oh, I love it when you talk like that. Yeah. Uh-huh. NASDAQ. Four letters NASDAQ. 3, 2, or 1. That would be NYSE, probably. Now, I want to make sure I don't dismiss this. I can't remember whether I said or not. There are actually other exchanges in the United States. They're called regional exchanges. Like there's the Philadelphia Exchange and several others. So I tend to ignore those kind of inappropriately, but there are some good stocks that trade on those exchanges. But we look at these. Now, Netflix is a huge company. It started on the NASDAQ as a smaller company, and it just stayed on the NASDAQ. It didn't go over to the big boys at the New York Stock Exchange. It's quite comfortable where it is. Netflix is a difficult story to describe, simply because Netflix has a lot of a massive base of revenue, virtually global. But that's also one of its worst weaknesses. It has no more markets. It's essentially made it to the top of the mountain, and there's no place to go from there except through increases in subscription prices, which will eventually eat it alive because competitors can come in underneath it with the with great service, great movies, shows, and all that, and pick off Netflix's customers because they're sick and tired of having their subscription fees jacked up. So yes, Netflix is a big, freaking huge company. However, it is a company that is risky. And I'll tell you how you tell how risky a company is. And we'll go into this in several different times this week, this semester. These same metrics, but I'm going to take you through it once, how to read a stock price, and then we'll just do it again and again and again until you're so sick of it that you won't want to see it anymore. First things first, Netflix closed yesterday at 87.05. It opened this morning at 82.51. Now, how could that happen? The market was closed. To you, it was, but the market, there is an aftermarket and a pre-market. In other words, there are orders being put in after hours and before the opening bell. Those orders, there are some buy orders, there are some sell orders. And so once that bell dings, those orders clear. If there were more sells than buys building up, then the price will go boom at the opening. If there are more buys than sells, then the price will go pop at the opening. You see here that it dropped? That means in the aftermarket and the pre-market, the on-balance volume of orders was to the sell side. That's why yesterday it closed at what? 87.05, but it opened and suddenly the sell orders overran the buy orders, so the price settled down. So we had an opening that was below the close. The opening this morning was below the close because of the unbalanced volume of sell versus buy orders on it. And I will keep repeating this. You'll get the hang of it. It'll be second nature to you. It always is by the end of this class. Now, the next thing to look at, thank you, is the bid and the ask. Now, I hate how your book does it, because they teach it to you from the view of the broker, not from the view of you, the investor. I teach it to you from the view of the investor. You see that bid price there? That is the price at which you could sell a share of Netflix. You call your broker, I want to sell one share of NFLX at market. You would have go into your account $83.70. However, if you say, I want to buy one share NFLX at market, you would pay $84.90. You're saying, well, wait a minute, that's a ripoff. You're going to have to buy it. I'm the broker. You call me, I'll sell you that share for $84.90. And you'll say, now, wait a minute there, fat boy. I heard that you just bought a share from someone at $83.70. That's right. And you know why that is? Tell me, why would it be that I would sell it at a price higher than I bought it? You're business people. Of course you're going to sell at a higher price than you buy. That's how you make your scratch. That's how you make your money. I have to buy it from you at a low price and then sell it to you at a higher price. That's the bid-ask spread. The bid-ask spread here is about what? $1.20, $1.20 on the bid ask. That's how I make my money in this business, is by selling it at higher prices than I buy it for. Now, that bid ask spread can be, look, if there's a lot of trading going on, I'm getting tons of orders, buys and sells, that bid ask spread is probably going to be pretty tight because I can make a lot of money just because I'm doing a lot of trades. But if the trading volume isn't as thick, we don't have dense trading volume, then that bid-ask spread tends to widen, separate more in those kinds of circumstances, because I'm going to have to make more on each trade. The spread has to be bigger because I don't have as many orders to fill. So that's something, and we'll talk about this. Remember that whatever price you see up there at the top, and I kind of took it out of the range of that price, that's really sort of just like, just something to look at, sort of like a place to talk about, 84.29. Now, sometimes we'll actually use that price for some of the things we do in class, but in the real world, you are going to pay attention to the bid-ask spread. It can kill you. So in other words, if you buy a share of Netflix right now, you are in the hole $1.20. You've got to climb $1.20 from what you bought it at before you can sell it at a price that's worth that makes you a profit. You see that? See, because if I buy a share of Netflix, I will pay $84.90. Well, I think, oh God, that was a mistake, I'll sell it. You're at a loss because you're going to sell it for only $83.70. So every time you buy a stock or a bond or a derivative instrument, you start out in the hole because you bought it at the ask. And if you sell it, you're going to sell it at the bid. So the first thing you have to pray for is that that bid is going to finally get past what the ask was when you bought it. So you're always going to be in the hole immediately when you buy, when you go. And by the way, you're here, I've been trying to keep myself from saying it. I almost did it there. Buy means, the way we say it, you go long. You go long. I want to go long 100 shares around lot, NFLX. Now, typically, and I'll get into this more later, you can say at market, and they'll just do what you tell them to do. But you can also set in your limit. Buy NFLX at 84.50 or better. That's a limit order. Don't do this order unless you can find a way to get me 84.50. That's a limit order. Again, I do this every day, and it gets to be comfortable to you. It's a language of ours. And the more you understand that language, the more you can interact with professionals who are going to help you buy and sell, because they will see more that you know what you're doing by using their language instead of common language. And that's one of the reasons I do this, is that you, every last one of you, is going to be an investor at some point. And so we have to, I have the duty to get you prepared for that life as investors. Whether you like it or not, you will invest. Okay, now, one quick thing. I'm not going to go through a lot of these ratios, these numbers this time, but here's one that you want to pay attention to. Beta. It is our golden number in finance. It is our measure of risk of a security. The one thing I caution you about beta is that beta has meaning only if you take investments seriously. If you have a portfolio and it's well diversified. Otherwise, beta doesn't mean a lot to you. Now, here's the thing. Any beta below one means that that stock has less risk than the world portfolio. Again, any beta below one has less risk than the world portfolio. Any beta above one has more risk than the world portfolio, than the market, as we say. So I see this beta of 1.71, and that is almost, that is vomit territory as far as risk goes. An amateur investor should not be in a stock this risky. That is insane risk. Now, if you're talking about a beta of 1.1, 1.2, I say, yeah, you're a risk taker, go for it. But when you get up there into this stratospheric beta like this, that's scary. To give you an idea, a beta of 1 is the market risk. You're riding the market. A beta of 0 would be something that has no risk whatsoever. Like a government treasury bill would have no risk. You're going to get paid. But anywhere above 0, there's going to be some risk. Like, for example, companies that do, you know, consumer goods like toilet paper and shampoo, they tend to have low betas. I mean, you're always going to, you know, people are always going to buy their products. But then you get above 1 and all hell begins to break loose. You're taking risk. And at 1.25, that's about where a sane amateur investor would want to be. Well, I made a fortune on a beta of 1.8. Good for you. That is a story you will hear, but you will never hear from all of the thousands, tens of thousands of investors who took the risk and got their asses kicked. You'll hear the guy, well, I invested in these risky stocks and I'll show you my system and you can make money like I can. You don't hear from the 50,000 who took the same shot that same day. They're not going to come to you, ha, I got my ass kicked in this stock and I can show you how to do it too. They're going to shut their mouths. They're not going to tell you what happened. That's the bias of positive information in markets. You hear from the one who won, and a lot of these geniuses and gurus out there, and I've met some of them, they just were the ones who got lucky on a bet. So some I can think of very specifically. You probably wouldn't recognize some of their names. But anyway, okay. There is sort of something. Now let me show you something just to give you a comparison. Netflix. The next one I'll show you is Pfizer. Pfizer makes medicine. Makes medical stuff. Look at its... Where the hell is its... Really? Pfizer. Oh, am I in Google? I am. Yep, I'm in Google. Let's try that again. PFE. I don't know how I got over there. PFE. Pfizer. Three letters. NYSE. Okay, let's look at its beta. I don't know. Yeah, look at that. See that beta? 0.43, below 1. It's a safe stock. It sells safe stuff. It's so large that it's not going to be wiped out. It's just going to always be there. You're going to take a lower risk. Of course, you're going to expect a lower return when you do that. But at least you're not on the edge of your bed every night hoping to God the pre-market doesn't beat you to death before the opening bell. Now, on the other hand, let me take you one. My favorite to show off is TSLA. Does anyone know TSLA? That's right. That company run by he of the cloven hoof. That is 1.84. That is not the territory for anyone who has normal risk profile. It is just crazy risky. Let me do another one in the same turf. It might actually surprise me with a lower beta than it used to have, but NVIDIA, NVDA. You probably heard about it. Beta 2.31. You hear these, well, I'd invest in NVIDIA. We have a rule that used to be rock solid, spoken by God. It was called appropriate investment. In other words, you don't tell everyone to invest in NVIDIA. You find investors who have the wherewithal, the understanding of the company, and the funds to lose. Literally, you need investors who are willing and able to lose a lot of money. Now, they'll also have a very good chance of making a lot of money, but there you are. Let me show you one more on the other side. I'm thinking consumer Colgate Palmolive, CL. Whoops, didn't mean to do that. CL, is that it? Colgate Palmolive, yeah. They make toothpaste, stuff like that. Look at the beta. Do you see the pattern? High beta, high risk. And betas are used by us, the professionals in this business. And so it is not some magic or some hokum or something that you can lie about and you can have your thugs force people to shut up when they tell you that you're lying. No, these are numbers that are formed from millions and millions of trades every day. These numbers are not some conspiracy. They're not manipulated. They are the data. Data over dogma, as we say. And so you see, and it makes sense. You get these safe companies that make safe stuff that's sold even if there's a recession against these companies that are into AI and into electric cars and all of that kind of stuff. Matter of fact, speaking of electric cars, let's have a look at another one in that business. RIVN. Let's see if this industry, or if it's just Tesla. Yep. See it? It's a risk. It's a high technology. Artificial intelligence and graphics cards. That's NVIDIA. Those are risky investments. But making consumer stuff like shampoos, toothpaste, soap, toilet paper, those are safe things to make because everyone will always buy those. Everyone won't always buy AI enhancement or the best graphic card out there or an electric car. You see how this works? What I'm doing is I'm not just telling you, well, these numbers, I'm telling you, why these numbers and what they talk to you. The numbers mean really in and of themselves. Numbers never mean anything unless you understand the relative number, the relatives of it, and the context around which it is being reported. So that gives you an idea of where we are. Why don't you do your attendance radar right now before I forget to. And while you're doing that, looking for a new victim up here. You, sir, in that dark blue. Yeah. You see, you come to me, it turns out you're my son. Okay, I have regrets. You are one of, no. But you come to me, hey, Dad, don't call me Dad. Can I borrow $100? And I say, well, you can kiss my butt. I don't have $100. So you are my daughter. Say no, it's bad. I mean, my kids are still in therapy. I mean, you know, she's got a comfort animal. It's a duck. I mean, you know, okay. So here, you come to me and you say, I need $50. I say, yeah, I got $50. Oh, I have Denny's. No, you're not getting it. Oh, I have enough for Denny's. Grand Slam, you know, apple pie, coffee. Here's the thing, though. You see, I am a surplus economic unit. I have extra scratch. You are a deficit economic unit. You need some money. So what we are facing here is this question of how do surplus and deficit economic units get together? You've got these deficit economic units here. And you've got these surplus units here. Now, the process of putting them together is called financial intermediation. I didn't spell that right. Financial intermediation. Financial intermediation is the matching of surplus and deficit economic units. Financial intermediation is the matching of surplus and deficit economic units. Financial intermediation is the matching of surplus and deficit economic units. Now, I repeated that definition three times. So what do you think the chances are that I will ask that on a quiz or an exam? You got it, Ace. I will oftentimes, I will say it, but then I just repeat the definition two or three times. Just give you a chance to get it into your notes exactly as I say it. And be careful about exactness. There's some terms I will say in this class, and you'll find a definition kind of like mine on the internet, but you'll lose all the points for it because it's not perfect. Because the internet doesn't need to be perfect. All it needs is to entertain you and make you feel empowered. The sales pitch is empowerment. The price is dependence on ignorance. I brought up the first one. There can't be a matching. You and I couldn't match because the amount wasn't the same. But it was in this one. So we talk about the level. That is just a fancy word for the amount. That would be the first one. Now, you say, I will pay you back in a year. I say, the hell you won't. You will. I need it back this week. No deal. So this one failed, not because the amount wasn't the same, but because the timing of the cash flows wasn't the same. So that's the second necessary condition for successful intermediation, is timing. So I say, okay, fine, I'll take it in a year. Whatever, you know, you're my kid. And then I see you go out of the house and you get on the back of a motorcycle ridden by a guy named Biff, who is going to take you to a garage where the guys wear gas masks. Now, you're not breaking, you're breaking bad. So I say, get back here, woman! Give me my money back. Because you're too risky. You could very well be in jail or dead, or heaven knows you might end up, you know, doing something really, really bad, like starting to listen to, you know, Beyonce. So the third pillar is risk. They have to have, there has to be a matching of risk. So the financial intermediation is the matching of surplus and deficit economic units based upon level, timing, and risk. Based upon level, timing, and risk. Financial intermediaries are the ones that bring together, like banks. Now, there are commercial banks. No, there are commercial banks. Those are for the you and me, businesses, small businesses, households. there are investors, the people who save money in the banks, and then the people who want to get loans. Those are financial intermediaries. The ones with which you are most familiar is the commercial bank. And then there are other larger, more complex things called financial services companies that offer a lot more services. Like, for example, Citibank is part of Citigroup, which offer the banks do banking, but the Citigroup does things that are broader, financial planning and things like that, or helping companies with revolving credit lines, cash management, things like that. So those are out there too. They also might even offer insurance, which used to be illegal, but now they do it all the time because of the law that prevented them from doing that kind of extra stuff was taken away in the late 1990s. But anyway, there's another kind of bank out there. It's used the word bank, but it's not a commercial bank. It's not a financial services company. It's a type of bank. Well, let me write commercial banks here. This is called an investment bank. An investment bank. I am pretty sure that no one in this class, unless you are a really hotshot finance major, will ever set foot in an investment bank. And I'll bet you don't know what they do. Okay. You saw when Facebook went public. Well, I bought in the IPO, the initial public offering. I bought Facebook on the IPO. No, you didn't. I'm Facebook. I'm not going to sell I need to raise $5 billion by selling stock, new crisp stock. I will never sell it to you. I will sell it to an investment banking syndicate. It's a cluster of these investment banks that buy the entire issue. What? 500 million shares, something like that? They buy it all. And that's called an underwriting, a firm underwriting. You are Facebook. I am an investment bank. We come to the agreement, and I get together these other investment banks, create the syndicate. We buy all of that stock that you're going to sell. We just write you a check. Here's your $5 billion. That's all there is to it. Then what do we do with it? We jack the price of it. We pump that stock up. We pump it up. We make sure that our best rich clients are able to buy it at the price at the initial price. And then what we do is we pump it up. We drive that price up. And then from our own books, the stock that we have, and the books of our rich clients like you, we sell it to the suckers like you and me. That's how stock markets work. That's an IPO. Well, I bought in the IPO. No, you did not. The IPO was subscribed out by the investment banking syndicate. Then that is called the primary market. Everything that happens after that is just buyers and sellers trading stock. That's what you see in the on those screens that I show you every day. That's a secondary market. It's just buyers and sellers interacting, getting rid of stock, buying stock for their portfolios, and all of that kind of stuff. So in other words, the division is primary versus secondary markets. You will always participate, and so will I, in the secondary market. We will never be an investment bank. We couldn't afford to be. They buy, okay, there are these huge multinationals. They'll do these IPOs. They'll underwrite IPOs everywhere. And then there are more regional types. They're still big, but they're not on this global scale. As a matter of fact, about 10 years ago, I took a group of my students up to a regional in Chicago. It was huge. I knew someone there, and so they brought my students in. They talked about, yeah, this is a great life. You know, it'd be one of our people. We got jobs, we got internships, and all that kind of stuff. But I mean, they had. I looked at their map, and they had offices all over the country, and they also they had another map. And I'm pretty sure I saw a couple of dots in Europe, and several in Canada too. So, you know, it's not like they're tiny. They're just not as big as if I'd walked into an investment bank on Wall Street, where it's basically the whole global map is red dots of their offices in every major city and even some sort of mid-sized cities. But anyway, that's primary versus secondary markets. Now, I had done some division earlier too. Oh, by the way, these are both financial intermediaries, the commercial banks and the investment banks. And there are other kinds of financial intermediaries too. It would surprise you at the number of different kinds of sort of like banks there are. They're like savings and loans. There are not as many as there used to be because there was a crisis in the late 1980s. Then there are mutual banks, which are kind of cool. Mutual banks, they are very durable in recessions. They don't buckle very easily. And here's how they work. Essentially, you don't just go in and say, I want to open a checking account. A mutual bank takes an application, and then they review you. They look you up and down. Because if you have an account with them, you become an owner, one of the owners of the bank. And they, at the community level, there have been several times we have good data that shows that these are much more likely to survive bad recessions than your typical banks will. So that's one out there. And then there's one that you probably are familiar with called credit unions. They are financial intermediaries. I deposit my checks there, so they've got money to lend, and then there are people who go in there to borrow money on for cars and homes and stuff like that. So they're definitely a financial intermediary. And then you have other ones. Like, for example, one that most people have no idea is around is a huge surplus economic unit, our life insurance company. Now, I think I've already told you this in class, but I want to remind you of this. You, sir, are going to die someday. You know that, right? You're okay with that. I mean, yeah. It could happen, you know, in a year. It could happen. You could walk out the door and the train could derail, ding, 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 and you are ground meat. But that's probably not going to happen. You're probably going to live 70, 80, in your case 40, no, 100 years. So you see, if you're putting premiums into a life insurance for a life insurance policy, they probably won't need that money from you to give as a death benefit to you for decades to come. So they are just flooded with all of this money, capital that they can use for lending, for investments. They are a massive surplus economic unit. As a matter of fact, for a very long time, when school districts needed to borrow money or afford to build a new school, or a municipality needed to borrow money to lay in a new sewerage system, a lot of times they would just simply do a direct subscription from life insurance company. Banks too. Banks had money. Life insurance company, they would just, oh yeah, okay, well, you know, we'll make the terms, how long it'll take you to pay it back, and you're going to raise your property taxes to earmark for what we're going to do here and all that kind of stuff. They're just very common at that. Now, there are other types too of these. There, oh, I should mention pension funds. pension funds are very large surplus economic units. I'll tell you, I say this, but I also have kind of a practical side to talking about this. When I'm not here in this building teaching finance, we have a program where we bring Ministry of Finance officials from West Africa and the Caribbean here, and I teach them finance, real hardcore crash courses. This one in like a long day session for 2 to 4 weeks. But they came last year, I think it was maybe the year before that, they had a delegation from the Ministry of Finance of the government of a West African country. What they wanted to do was set up a pension fund for the for the people who work for the government. And they, what they would do is they would provide a benefit, what they called a complement, at the time of retirement for the rest of the person's life. And then, but of course, as a person worked, they'd be taking out some money every month, every paycheck, to put into the pension fund. Now, the logic is always good because you're building up this capital reserve from the pension, from the people working 30, 40 years for the government. And then when they retire, they can get a nice check to keep themselves alive in their old age. Great idea. But interestingly enough, they said, well, you've got to earn money. All this money that's coming in, you've got to earn money on it. And they said, well, we're not allowed to invest in your stock markets and things like that. How do we do this? And so there were a couple of ideas that we put forth, and I don't know how far they've gotten yet. But one way was to create a captive bank of the pension fund, and then they could lend money to the government workers when they wanted a car, when they wanted a home. That bank would be the surplus economic unit to provide for these workers. And the beauty of it is that the payments on a loan would just be taken out of their paychecks like the pension fund premiums would. So yeah, pension funds can be a vast ocean of surplus for transactions. Now there are a few other ones that I'll bring here. I would be remiss not to exchange traded funds, ETFs. Now, I will go into more detail on these at a later time. They are a huge idea, good idea for responsible investors. And then there is something that's kind of like them, a mutual fund. And then there are two that are nasties. One of them is sort of a white hat, black hat. Those are called hedge funds. They can do a lot of good in helping to deflect risk from companies. But the one that is about as evil gets, those are called private equity funds. Private equity funds, and I'll talk more about those in the weeks to come. But if you want to play with the devil, knowing full well that you're going to lose, you will engage your company that needs help with a private equity fund. They'll provide you with their surplus capital for your deficit needs, and then they will destroy you. It happens almost every time. Okay, now back to markets. Very quickly, just let me conclude. Financial, and I did this one last time, versus physical markets. Here's one, spot markets versus forward markets. Spot versus forward. Let me explain. You, madam, I work at McDonald's and you come through the drive-thru and I say, may I help you, McPlease? And you say, why, McYes? I would like a McBurger and a McFries. Would you like a McDrink too? Why, McYes. And so you come up and you've looked at the sign and you say, and I say, well, that is $25.38. And you say, McOMG. That is a spot market. When you go to the gas station, you pay the price that is posted right then and there. That's spot. You're paying spot. Now let me give you an idea of how forward markets work. And they are vast. They are oceans. You, madam, are a coffee house owner in Chicago, okay? You have a nice operation, and you roast your own beans, and they smell great, and everyone in the downtown stops by your kiosk to buy coffee. It's a great place. But you see, the price of coffee right now per pound, the kind that you use that is so loved, is $3.50 per pound. Okay. You call me. I am in someplace in Central America, and let's say Nicaragua or Guatemala, okay? You say, okay, what would you do if I wanted to buy 1,000 pounds of coffee in 6 months? Well, I would think to myself, okay, 6 months, I will deliver to you 1,000 pounds of coffee at $3.40 per pound in 6 months. That's a forward price. Because it's not going to happen now. It's not the spot. The spot is $3.50. Now, we said $3.40. It could have been $3.60 based upon our perceptions. But we have agreed upon, we have shaken our hands on a future price for delivery of 1,000 pounds of coffee. So let's say that in 6 months, the price, the spot, is $3.70. You see, you will pay me only $3.40. So you have saved 30 cents per pound by the forward contract. Now, I, as the coffee producer, have lost 30 cents a pound because I could have sold it for $3.70 and I'm going to sell it for only $3.40. So I lost. However, suppose we have the other scenario. Suppose that spot in 6 months is $3.20 per pound. Well, I could have bought it, you could have bought it at $3.20. On the spot in 6 months. But instead, you and I have an agreement that you have to pay me $3.40 for it. So in this case, it looks like I won. But in fact, in both of these cases, we have both won. Why? Because you see, from my end, you would have paid $3.70, but you got $3.40. Now, I feel like maybe I got cheated here. But actually, not really, because you see, I, back here, know exactly how much I'm going to make in revenue in 6 months. Knowing anything with perfect certainty on a financial statement is golden. I don't really even worry about the fact that the spot went above the forward. I know that 6 months before, I've got a crystal ball. I know what my revenue will be. The same thing over here. If spot had fallen to 320 and I had 350, doesn't really matter because I knew what my cost, exactly what it would be in 6 months. No risk. That's it. Okay, that's all I have for you today. I thank you.